This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hey there, this is Nicholas Logue, author of Crown of the Kobold King, and you are listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 42. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this very special episode, we will be finding our inner beast and imbibing in a bloody brew with Nicholas Logue, who was just announced as the author of the new Open Design project. Welcome again to episode 42 of The Tome, Nicholas Logue and the Open Design Project 5, Blood of the Gorgon. For those of you who are new to the show, here to check out the skinny on the new Open Design Project and its author, welcome. For those longtime listeners, well, now you start to understand why I pushed out the last four episodes so quickly. I had a chance to bring you this special interview, and I wasn't allowed to talk about it until it was announced, and now here it is. I don't have much more to talk about other than I have many other reviews planned and in the works, including more novel reviews such as Orc King, more gamebook reviews such as Grand History of the Realms, and more 4th edition talks such as the ones you heard with Chris Engler in recent episodes, as well as a review of Preview Classes and Races. But without further ado, because I don't like to ramble on too much to start things off, I bring you the interview with Nicholas Logue, or Rockstar in Dizzle, as I like to call him behind his back.
Thanks, my man. All right.
Hello, everyone. Today, I'm very excited to be here with Nicholas Logue. Nick is well known around the D&D gaming industry. He's written many articles for Dungeon, Dragon, and Kobold Quarterly. Plus, he's been published with Wizards of the Coast and has been a bit of a rock star over at Paizo. Today we're going to get to know Nick a little bit better, and we're going to talk to him about the new Open Design project. Welcome to The Tome, Nick.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing? Good to be here.
Doing great, and I'm glad to have you. Glad to have you here. Now, before we get into the real meat of my questions, my traditional first question on the show is: how did you first start playing D&D?
Oh, how did I get into the addiction, as it were?
Yeah.
Let's see. I started playing Dungeons & Dragons when I was about 8 years old, and it was great because I had absolutely no idea how to play the game whatsoever. My older brother gave me his books because he couldn't figure them out, and he was like, maybe my younger brother can figure this out, so he handed them off to me, and I was like playing at lunchtime with my friends, and we had no idea what we were doing. It was great. I was like, you're a wizard. You're fourth level. You can cast fourth level spells. So it was hilarious. I had no idea, like, you know, that you couldn't just get hit points back whenever you wanted. And you know, we sort of just told these wild stories while we played the game, and I had a very nebulous grasp of the rules. And that nebulous grasp of the rules thing has sort of stuck with me throughout the various editions. But I've had a good time playing it. So yeah, I was about eight. I played with my first character's name was Bash Clash. It's a perfect 8 year old character name. He was a fighter. Who eventually some incarnation of him made it to immortality, when the gold set came out there. So it was great stuff, you know. And from D&D, I jumped to all sorts of different games. Played Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Another Strangeness, Marvel Superheroes, Shadowrun. Pretty much played the gambit of the games. But D&D I always came back to. I would leave it for a year here and there, but I would always end up picking it up and really playing the heck out of it at some point, so... Yeah.
We seem to have a very similar gaming background, except I had a friend's older brother who actually knew the rules, but I did the same sort of thing. Even at the age of eight is when I started, and we did
awesome.
We did the same sort of thing, and we'd play it, you know, at recess at school and that kind of stuff, and then I jumped around to all kinds of games and always ended up back at D&D, and now here I am doing a show about it.
Oh, that's fantastic, yeah. Man. Right on. It takes you places, D&D. It's a journey.
It's a great game.
Great. Yeah, definitely.
So it's being announced today, or the day that this is released anyway, that you are going to be the new solo author of the new Open Design Project. Can you quickly explain to people what the Open Design Project is all about?
Yeah, open design is a really, really awesome thing that Wolfgang has been doing for a long time that I've been sort of just in awe of. It's a great idea. One, because I feel like for me, you know, adventure design is kind of part art form. You know, I'm a theater artist and a playwright in my day job. So when you're designing an adventure, it's kind of like art in a way, and it's a good time. And any really good art is collaborative. And the way open design works is that patrons sign up to be a part of the process, basically. They sign up basically to be a part of the design process. They're on a private blog with the author, where the author posts design essays, and you know, they also do lots of blogging and talking back with the patrons. And part of it is so we give patrons an inside look at exactly how an adventure is written or constructed or formed. And the other part is so that patrons can actually teach us some things. They can say, hey, you know, I would really like to see something like this. Maybe you could use this kind of monster, or maybe this element to the adventure, or maybe, you know, the plot could go this way. And we take suggestions and roll them into the actual work. So it becomes a real collaborative effort, not just a designer somewhere in a tower writing something, but a designer writing something for a community of gamers who are giving direct feedback during the process. And I think that's really, really hot. I think it's a very sexy way to do an adventure design, personally.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I know lots of people would love to have that, be able to add that personal touch to their adventures, and yet still have the convenience of a pre-made adventure, so to speak.
Totally.
You know, they get their own input into it, so you sort of get a little bit of a hands-on experience with designing that.
Yeah, it's totally true. I mean, even if you're looking for a certain kind of game for your home game, I mean, you bring whatever your requirements are to the table, and you can say, hey, can we try to do something like this? Because it would work well for me in my home game. And we as the designer and the other patrons can kind of compromise and find ways to make the adventure work for everybody, which is great. It really cuts down on the time you have to do at home, you know, tweaking the adventure, because you kind of helped us tweak it for you in the design process. That's a great way of putting it, yeah. The hands-on, like you said, Jeff.
Well, I imagine it's an interesting way as an author or as a game designer to work on it also, because you're getting some instant feedback instead of having to do a finished product and then wait for the reviews to come in or whatever. You're getting feedback during the process.
Yeah, I'm really going to relish that, because I enjoy feedback, especially because, you know, as an artist, I always want to get stronger at everything I do, whether it be acting or writing or adventure design. So feedback is very important to me. Because it really helps me deliver better for the people who read my work. And then it's great if I can actually get feedback in the process, because then the work just gets stronger and I can also ask questions back. Sometimes you read a review and you're like, gee, I really wonder what they meant by that. You know, and now if someone, you know, if I'm blogging and someone posts a comment, I can say, oh, cool, this is good feedback. What do you mean exactly? What were you looking for?
Sure.
And I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
Great. So it's going to be about a 50,000-word adventure.
Yes, 50,000 words or so.
How does that compare with other published adventures that people might know?
It's like, you know, it's about a 64-page adventure, I would say. It's probably what if you think of, like, you know, the little 32-pagers that Wizards puts out, or the Game Mastery modules that Paizo Publishing puts out, the various game mastery modules they do, those are about 25,000 words, maybe 23,000 words a pop. So this would be double that length.
Okay. Yeah. So how long would you expect a group of players to play an adventure of this length?
That's an excellent question. I find that adventure, like word count per actual play experience, the mileage really varies. For example, I have a friend of mine who's been playing through Crown of the Kobold King, which is a Paizo game mastery adventure that I wrote, and they've been playing for I think they're on their 10th session or something, and they haven't even left Falcon's Hollow, which is the little town where the adventure begins, you know. And so it kind of depends on how much your group gets into, you know, role-playing aspects of things. But if you're talking encounter by encounter by encounter, probably I would say you're going to get maybe 50 or so encounters out of a 50,000 word adventure, somewhere around there. So probably a good amount of time. I would think you could get a good solid, you know, this is just a guess, but 12, maybe even 20 sessions out of it.
Okay. So what kind of level range would you expect this adventure to be for?
That's a good question. One of the fun things about the adventure is that the I have no real set idea of the power or intensity of the antagonist as of yet. Kind of could be for anything. I'm really looking forward to see what people want. Probably because it's going to be a mystery adventure. A little bit on the lower to mid scale is always better for those. You don't have a lot of divination spells breaking the bank or breaking the plot.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing probably below 12th level, below 10th level maybe, but anywhere in there would work fine for me. So I'm excited to see what the patrons would like.
Okay. So we've got the name of it. It's the Blood of the Gorgon.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got an idea of length, and you've got a brief summary that you've put out there sort of what the story is all about.
Right.
How well have you developed and set those stories already? How much room is there still for patrons to sort of guide where that story goes?
Oh, I've left a ton of room. I don't even really have a plot outline for the adventure. As much as I have some themes, I'm really interested in exploring and then seeing what kind of plot the patrons bring to the table. So what I have basically is I'm drawing on two sources for the adventure. I like to do allusions to a lot of real world literature or real world mythology, but I kind of like to do them in pairs. I find that when you just do a real world illusion, just one, it can come off sort of stale, or it can come off just like whatever you were using for the illusion. And it's always nice to bring some originality to it. And one way to do that is to choose two myths or stories and mesh them together and see what kind of weird repercussions they have on each other. So the two stories I've decided to use as my basic like theme building blocks are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and the myth of Asclepius, the son of Apollo, who's one of the first healers in mythology, who discovers that the blood of the Gorgon has the power to restore people to life, but that it also has the power to kill them if taken from the wrong side of the monster. So that I'm using those two themes to build this entire adventure. The plot is pretty simple so far. I have some elements I want to bring to it. I like the idea of a sprawling, shadowy cabal of thieves or some sort of criminal organization. I want the patrons to help me design. And then I have this main villain who's a misunderstood villain who, of course, has some serious problems. He's, he's unlocked a sort of side of himself that he can't put back in the box. And now he's sort of rampaging through the night, and maybe he's even taken over this guild of criminals. And the PCs are investigating murders and crimes that this guy's committing. But I don't have a lot beyond that. I'm really looking forward to actually building it as we go.
Great. So can you describe a little bit of the setting for this adventure? You said it's urban.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be urban. I rapped with Wolfgang a bit about this, and I thought it would be fun to set it in his open design default setting, the Free City of Zobek, mostly because I find that Zobek's feel really matches, not matches, but it meshes with or can be adapted easily to Eberron's feel. And I have kind of a track record of writing urban adventures set in Sharn, City of Towers, or other urban centers in Eberron. And I would like this adventure to be very easily adaptable to Eberron for any fan of that setting who would like to take it and maybe slip it into any other Nick Loeb trilogy that is already out there, like the Victor Saint-Domingue trilogy, which is a trilogy of adventures that appeared in Dungeon. Mm-hmm. That are pretty well known, and I'd like this to be able to kind of like fit into a campaign that you're running in Sharn, City of Towers, or fit into a campaign, maybe even in Kalimport, in the Forgotten Realms.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's set in Zobek, but I'm gonna make sure that it's very adaptable to any urban environment.
Okay, great. So you seem to be going for a very sort of psychological or even spiritual thriller sort of story.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah, that's definitely there.
Okay, so how do you take that sort of psychological or spiritual aspect of a story and integrate that into a system of rules like what we have with D&D?
Cool, very good question. One thing I want to explore in this adventure is playing with the PC's experience of what's happening. For example, it's very easy to say, hey, isn't this terrifying? Aren't you scared? And the PC can always be like, yeah, I guess I'm scared. I just draw my sword and I cut this guy down, whatever. You know what I mean? It's for me, it's creepier when the terror comes from within. So I don't want to give away too much, but one of the elements of the adventure that I'm looking forward to exploring is a certain effect and the rules mechanics that will be used on the PCs that actually the Dungeon Master may be able to keep the players from knowing about until, you know, near the climax of the adventure. So it's kind of like an experiential journey for the characters, as well as a rollicking high action adventure where you're fighting over this urban landscape. So, and I'm going to introduce a little bit of mechanic subset to deal with that.
All right, so a new little secret bit of rules to really mess with people without letting them know, huh?
A little bit, yeah. I'm going to try to keep it so it's not. I never liked the idea of deprotagonization, the idea of taking away the control of a character from the player. I think that's a horrible idea. It can take away a lot of the fun elements of Dungeons & Dragons, of this portrayal of this hero that you're in control of. But there's a way to do it, I think, where you don't deprotagonize the PCs at all, but you actually add to their role-playing experience and add to the gaming experience and like add to the conflicts that they're facing in the adventure. And instead of saying, hey, you know, you're dominated, you're doing this now, buddy, sorry. You know, there's other ways to do it instead of doing that, where you kind of play with the information you give them, or maybe some of the information they think they're perceiving isn't actually true, but because of the spell effects or because of the whatever, you know, evil artifact or evil power is affecting them, they're getting, you know, false reads on things, information that is incorrect, that leads them down a certain path. That to me is more fun, and because you eventually, you know, you have chances to realize what's happening and take action against it, as opposed to just say, oh, you've been affected by suggestion, and so you're just going to do this now. So.
Okay, great. Sounds like it's an interesting way to use a mechanical element to sort of put things on their head. You're still leaving the power in the hands of the PCs. You're just affecting the kinds of information that they're getting.
Exactly, because I like the idea of mind control or things like where a side of the PC's personality is being expressed without them knowing it. But I don't like it when it's in a way that's where the DM is like, hey, buddy, you're not in control of your character right now. I am. So there's okay. there's ways to sort of convince the players, get them into moral conundrums, and then have it be a journey that they actually went through, as opposed to a journey where they stepped back and watched you control their characters for them. Yeah.
Okay. So the story the adventure is called Blood of the Gorgon.
Mm-hmm.
How likely is it that a Gorgon will actually appear in the story?
Ah, good question. Well, we know the blood of a Gorgon will. So there's probably a good chance there will be Gorgons in the adventure, or Gorgon-like beings in the adventure. And now that leads into an interesting question of what kind of Gorgon will we use. You know, will we use a Gorgon from the Monster Manual, or are we going to use a Gorgon more from the Greek mythology of what a Gorgon is? Paizo has just sort of they've just done an excellent job remastering a lot of the classic monsters. In fact, they have a book coming out called Classic Monsters Revisited. I think it comes out this month or next month. I've sneak peeked a lot of it because I wrote a portion of it, and it's amazing. And we may be revisiting the Gorgon in this adventure, Blood of the Gorgon, and doing interesting things with it. So yes, there will be Gorgons. What kind? Who knows?
I see. Maybe both.
Yeah, maybe. In fact, Paizo redid the Gorgon in their recent Rise of the Rune Lords campaign, and they did an excellent job. The Gorgons in that one are very, very intense and a closer cleaving to Greek myth.
Okay, great. So it almost seems like there might be a little bit of a monster hunt element in the story. How do you mesh a monster hunt with an urban environment? Because normally you just don't have monsters running rampant through a city. That would be a bit noticeable.
This is very true. So one of the fun things we'll be doing with Blood of the Gorgon is it's definitely going to be an adventure that has a lot of murder mystery elements to it, at least in the initial stages of the adventure. So the monster is, of course, you know, sort of acting at night stealthily and potentially with the aid of other shadowy beings and creatures. so that, you know, you're coming upon these crime scenes after the fact in the beginning of the adventure and trying to piece things together. So there'll be a lot of murder mystery element to it. So the monster's rampage is, like, I guess, less of a rampage and more of a preying upon the people of this community.
Okay. Yeah. So in some of the information you sent me ahead of time, you mentioned that the encounters for the adventure will be heavily playtested. What does that process look like? How do you heavily playtest something like this?
Well, I'd like to really harness the patrons for that as well, and you know, hand over some of the encounter work earlier to them if it's possible, and let them playtest it with their groups and see how it goes. I'll always, of course, be conducting my own playtests, especially in New York. It's very easy for me since I've moved. I have a lot of gamer friends here. There's an excellent community called NerdNYC. You can check them out on www.nerdnyc.com. There's a ton of people playing all sorts of games in New York, and they run regular events all through the city, and it's very easy to rustle up a group of people and play a great game, you know, through these people. So I'll probably be using nerdnyc.com to rustle up a lot of playtest groups, and I'll be running a bunch myself with some very close personal friends of mine who live in the city here.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I know from the side of a patron, it seems like, well, on one hand, it seems to be neat to be able to be involved in the playtest process of something like this that I've, you know, that I'm going to end up purchasing. And at the same time, do I really want to playtest encounters with my group when I'm later going to be running them through the adventure and they're going to be encountering those things, you know?
So it's sort of a
balance of, do I, you know, I want to be in on the ground floor, and at the same time, I don't want to spoil the story.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, in fact, I may, you know, of course, we'll have to see which patrons are interested. Maybe they have another group they want to use it on first. But yeah, you're right. I'll see if there's any interest in that, and if not, I'll have to tap all the community here in NYC and do it myself.
Sure.
But even if I do that, I want to make sure that I bring maybe even actual play posts to the design experience for the patrons so that they can at least see how the playtests went, really blow by blow, and sort of check it out. If that's possible to do, and I think it will be, I think that would be an excellent way to really give them an inside look at the playtesting and the changes to the process that playtesting will entail.
Or find somebody with a microphone and put out an actual play podcast of it.
That would be awesome. Yeah. I thank you. Now that you're teaching me about this technology here. I can totally do that. Maybe do a live podcast of it. That's a great idea.
There's plenty of shows out there that all, you know, most of their show is just them running through adventures, and it's just, you know, listening for 2 hours of their group playing through an adventure. So
that's crazy. That's awesome.
There's a market for it out there. People enjoy listening to that.
Oh, right on. I'll definitely do that, man. I love dungeon mastering. It's a passion. It's my favorite thing to do in the whole world. And it would be totally wicked to just, like, record a whole session and you know, send it out there on the interwebs for people to enjoy. That'd be hilarious.
You bet.
Yeah.
So cool. Patrons also end up they get a PDF copy of the final work. But they also get a print copy.
Yes, they do.
What is the quality level of that print copy?
That's a good question. The quality level of the print copy depends on how many patrons we get. Wolfgang explained to me that, you know, the more patron funds we get in, the better quality he can look at as far as the production value. So I imagine it will be pretty excellent quality. I'm hoping that if we get enough patrons, we can even do full color interior, you know, really, really kicking artwork, you know, that kind of stuff. He has kind of a good track record with that with Cobalt Quarterly already. I love some of the artwork. I don't know where he's finding these people, but man, they're good. So, I think if we can get artwork on par with, what we see in Cobalt Quarterly, I'll be real happy with the way the quality turns out at the end.
Sure. So there's not a specific artist assigned to this kind of a project. They wait until the funds come in and then try to find artists to put together just images throughout the story, or?
You know, I don't know, actually. I'll have to ask Wolfgang about that process. It would be neat, even if it's not possible for Blood of the Gorgon, but to do in the future, to have, like, dedicated artists who are part of the open design process as well. I think that's a nifty idea. I don't know if that's how it works, or if it's going to work that way for Blood of the Gorgon, but I'll definitely rap with Wolfgang about that. Because, I, you know, art's more and more important nowadays in D&D adventures, because it really does visually bring things to life.
Oh, yeah. I know I make it a habit in my in a lot of the, you know, right now, for example, I'm running through the Cormyr adventure, pre-made adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I made it the first thing I did was go online, grab all those images, print them all off in full color, and then stick them in the book. So when we encounter this, you know, this monster, I can pull the picture out and slap it down on the table and say, this is what you see.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I love that when I'm playing, when a dungeon master takes the time to do that. Because they're like, boom, they whip it out, and you're like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, every time I fight a Minotaur in Dungeons & Dragons, I think of the picture of the Minotaur in the Monster Manual, which I love.
Sure.
And instantly, like, I'm in the fight. You know, I'm like, there it is, a fur all mangy coming at me with its horns. You know, this is awesome. And yeah, that's a great thing to do. So it would be neat, yeah, for open design projects to find a dedicated artist who is going to be visually committed to bringing whatever the patrons come up with to life. And they're part of the blogging, and they're, you know, they can even maybe post early sketches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great, you know.
Yeah, that would be really cool to integrate that part of the multimedia experience in with the patrons.
Yeah, I'll ask Wolfgang about it. I think that's a really nifty idea. Yeah.
All right, so as far as your writing process, I imagine this is going to be a bit of a different situation than what you're used to. So how do you intend to sort of work with this different sort of schedule and the extra, pressures or complications that come along with having patrons on a project? What do you anticipate this being like on your end?
That's a great question, and you've now shockingly made me realize how woefully terrified I am.
Well, sweet, I've scared you out of it. You can back out now.
No, you need a new author. No, yeah, it's thank you for asking that question, because as soon as I'm done with this interview, I'm going to sit down with some paper and try to come up with some really good answers to it. One thing I've done is clear a lot of my schedule for the design period. I want to be able to really give this my full focus. So I don't want to be like juggling three other projects and working on this at the same time. I have a lot of projects on my plate, and I've been making sure to sort of like that they all sort of tie up their loose ends before I really begin working with the patrons on this. I kind of want this to be what I want to be available, and I want to be blogging like as often as possible and really, really be involved with it. So I want to make sure that I don't have other things in my life at the time.
So are you going to make this sort of your full-time job during the 2 months of the process?
I plan to. I'm in one show at the time, but I'm only performing 2 days a week in that show. So I don't see why I couldn't just really devote myself to it. And that would be great.
Good deal. So is there anything else that people should know about this project that I'm just not picking up the clues that I should be asking about?
One thing I'm really excited about getting into is talking about adventure design as far as event-based adventures and murder mystery adventures. These two things are very elusive to many dungeon masters and many designers, and they happen to be types of adventures that I really enjoy writing. Whether I'm good at them or not, who knows, but I have a good time working on them. We'll find out with Blood of the Gorgon, won't we? So I'm really excited to examine those elements heavily. It's easy to sit down, and not easy, but it's a very different experience of D&D to sit down and, you know, create a map of a keep and populate the keep with monsters and then run that adventure. It's much harder when the adventure's themes demand scenes that, you know, take place in on their own timeline that is not preset and involves the PCs interacting with the plot in very interesting ways, such as investigating leads and, you know, trying to turn up clues and track down information about a certain person. And maybe they even meet the antagonist of the adventure early on but don't know who it is, and how do you deal with that? And so that's, you know, always these are the kinds of issues that I love to throw into adventures. I love a challenge, so I like to throw these out there. So I plan to, with Blood of the Gorgon, really, really challenge myself, and so that way I can really give patrons everything they pay for. Really, you know, show them how you tackle all these various issues in an adventure design when it's not just a kick in the door and fight the orc for his pie kind of adventure.
Sure.
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with that. I love kicking in the door and killing that orc and eating that pie. But sometimes it's fun to take adventures on a different track, and that's what I hope to do with Blood of the Gorgon, is really push the fringes of design as much as I can and see how much I can give the patrons for their experience there.
Yeah, and it's always difficult to get in that mystery element of a story in a world where magic is commonplace and do that kind of stuff, because you never quite know when they're going to pull out that magic rabbit that's going to answer the questions early on and ruin the whole planned adventure.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. And so one of the fun things to do is to try to figure out ways where you don't nullify the PC's ability to do those things, but you use the PC's ability to do it in different ways, so that you're not saying, hey, player, I know that you took that spell, but too bad. You know what I mean? But instead you're saying, oh, you're using that spell. Great. It's going to give you some information. It's not going to give you all the information you want because the bad guy took certain precautions. You know, like you could ask, for example, you find a corpse in an alleyway, its eyes torn out, right? And you're like, okay, I cast divination and I want to find out who killed the corpse, who killed this person. And so maybe, you know, the bad guy has thought about some of these questions ahead of time, so he tortured the person near to death and then let someone else actually, like, let some patsy he forced into doing it strike the killing blow or something. So there's, you know, if you're an intelligent villain, and I like to think that, you know, some days I'm an intelligent villain. you find ways around, you know, certain things where it's gonna yield information to the PCs, but it's not gonna directly point to you, and that's fun because then it starts the PCs off on investigations. They're not bored. They're not lost. They're not just like, well, gee, why did I take this spell? But at the same time, it's not as easy as, oh, let's just go there and kill that guy then.
So, great. Yeah. Sounds like an interesting challenge.
Should be fun. I'm looking forward to really tackling it. So
great.
I think it will be a very dark adventure. A lot of mood to it. A lot of feel. Some very creepy scenes. But yet, you know, a strong core of cinematic adventure. So it should be fun.
Good deal. So you mentioned that you're sort of clearing your schedule, but that means that you've got other projects that you've been also working on. Is there anything coming up that we should be keeping an eye out from you?
Let's see. Stuff I'm working on now I mostly can't talk about because, you know, some things haven't been announced yet and whatnot.
Sure.
But I do have some stuff coming up soon. City of Stormreach, I believe, comes out in February, and I wrote a good chunk of that book. I have a Classic Monsters Revisited. I wrote the entry on ogres and the entry on bugbears in Classic Monsters Revisited from Paizo Publishing.
Was there a history to go to for bugbears outside of D&D?
You know, I went really towards the creepy, you know, boogeyman aspect of bugbears. I guess bugbears have commonly been associated with the boogeyman, and they get a bad rap in D&D as kind of like the thug of the goblin world.
Right.
So I didn't want to like negate the fact that they're the thug of the goblin world, but add another level to it in this creepy sense where they really enjoy fear. They really like enjoy the taste and smell of people's fear. And so they go out of their way. They're almost addicted to it. And so they go out of their way to incite absolute terror in a foe before they actually pounce on them. So, you know, they creep up to your window and you know, patter away at the glass a little bit, or, you know, crawl around in your attic so you hear the creak and you're not sure if it's the wind, but it's just enough of a sound to really get your hackles raised and your terror on edge, because the bugbears like to soak themselves in the scent of your terror before they actually kill you.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
So, yeah. And so that was a very fun project. Eric Mona and Jason Bowman were spearheading it, and it was really fun to work with them on totally re-envisioning these monsters. So it was neat stuff. What else? Actually, I have coming out as well. I have Hangman's Noose, a game mastery module for Paizo Publishing that comes out, I think, next month. And also Edge of Anarchy, which is the first installment of the Curse of the Crimson Throne adventure path for Pathfinder. It's Pathfinder number 7. And I'm very excited about that because it's the first time Paizo's let the first installment of a adventure path out of house. They let me have a crack at it. So
give it to a freelancer.
Yeah, I feel like I got to really sort of play with the cookie jar, you know, for a while there. And that was a very fun process. I worked very closely with James Jacobs, Wesley Schneider, and also Mike McArdor, who wrote Guide to Corvosa, which is the city that Edge of Anarchy is set in. Most of the path is set in. And Corvosa is a crazy place. That's all I have to say. It's pretty awesome.
Sure.
It's definitely up there as far as one of my favorite cities that I've ever seen or worked with as a designer. It's a very, very interesting place. Mike did a great job with the guidebook, and it's a kind of a brainchild of James as well and Wes, and it's really it's fascinating. So I think people will enjoy that. That comes out, I think, in 2 months. Yeah.
Okay. So how much freedom do you get in a project like that where there's several authors working on the overall path?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. With this one, it was neat too. They let me draw up an outline on my own in the beginning. Normally, in the adventure paths, we're given an outline, and it's pretty. You know, they leave a lot of room for us to have fun. The outline is maybe about a page long, or you know, a 60-page adventure or something. And so we have lots of room to play with things. But this time, I think they let most of the authors or all of them outline their adventures themselves, which was neat. And then we submitted the outline, and they gave us lots of feedback on it and submitted it back, and then we'd submit a draft, and they would give us feedback and submit it back. The only thing that's been difficult about working with the Pathfinder stuff is that it's a world that's being created as we're writing in it, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, James and Eric are kind of the real spearhead forces, you know, behind Galarian. Jason Bowman, too, behind Galarian, their new campaign world. So that's kind of being developed as we're writing these adventures set in that campaign world. So it's a really cool process because we get to sort of kick a few ideas in there and say, hey, what do you think about this? And they go, great, yeah, that's awesome. That's going in the campaign world. Or they say, oh, well, we already have some ideas for that, so you have to change it this way. And so it's a very, very, very interesting and very, very, very exciting design process to be working on Galarian right now.
Sort of like what it would have been like to get in on the early days of Green Ronin's Freeport or something like that.
Exactly, or like the ground floor of Eberron, for example.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like it's almost like designing a whole campaign setting. There's no canon you have to read and worry about. You can create the canon as you go, and then if James and Eric want changes, they'll just let you know. And that's super super cool as a designer because I really enjoy just coming up with wild ideas and wild places and wild NPCs and I've been given the opportunity to do that in Galarian, which is fun.
So it seems like between Paizo and Open Design, you're keeping yourself pretty busy.
Yeah, man, I need a vacation. But I'm not going to get one anytime soon. I'm hoping for the holidays this year. So 2008.
2008,
holidays.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'll take a few weeks off, and that'd be cool. You know what I mean? Wolfgang, he's been busy, and I know he's planning on taking a vacation finally after a very grueling 2007 of launching Cobalt Quarterly and writing Pathfinder modules and, you know, game mastery modules and just really churning out stuff. He's taking his first vacation to Hawaii, he was telling me, and I'm just so excited for him because I know exactly how he feels.
Sure. Yeah. Of course, if you're going to have a problem, having the problem of too much work in a field that you really enjoy probably isn't one to complain about too much.
Oh, no, not at all, man. Going to work every day is great. Like, you know, it's like going to work involves going to my couch.
Yeah.
And then creating crazy D&D stuff. And then, you know, round two of work is like calling my friends and playing it with them.
It's a rough life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a tough job. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No complaints. No complaints. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So is there anything else we should know about you?
I'm crazy. Most people have probably told you that if you've talked to anybody about me before the interview. I run this pretty wild thing at Gen Con every year called Iron Dungeon Master. That's definitely worth checking out. It's grown to over 100 people, this event, and it just keeps growing and growing. And it's based off course off of Iron Chef. It's a parody of Iron Chef, but involving adventure design. And it's pretty intense. If anyone wants to know more about it, we have a great website, www.irondm.com. And go scope that out if you want to find out more about Iron Dungeon Master. It's definitely worth checking out. I'm an actor. I bring a lot of theatricality to everything I do. I've been you know, acting for the stage since I was 14, and I've always enjoyed it. And I've been, besides writing adventure stuff, I write plays. I'm working on a screenplay right now that's been optioned by a small company. You know, anything creative really gets me going. I just enjoy working on wild stuff. I'm part of the Where Cabbages, the dangerous and deadly lycanthropic lettuce group of freelancers and game writers, a great group of guys and girls there that are full of talented people. People like Greg Vaughn, Rich Pett, Steve Greer, Wolfgang Bauer, Louis Agresta, Brendan Victorson. I'm forgetting some. There's like thousands of us now. It's awesome. But some really, really talented folks constantly putting out great stuff. So yeah, they have a website too, www.wherecabbages.com, that you can check out. It's pretty interesting. It has all sorts of updates on what the group is up to. That's always worth looking into. And yeah, I don't know what else. Oh, I choreograph stage combat. That's kind of exciting. So I get to play with you know, when I'm not sitting on my couch writing D&D stuff and playing D&D for a living, I'm playing with broadswords and shields for a living. So that's pretty fun.
Well, you do have a hard life, huh?
It's rough, man. Yeah. It's rough. I don't know.
And as I look through the list of the Were Cabbages, of the people involved, I seem to have interviewed quite a few members, and I didn't even realize some of them were members.
Oh yeah, yeah. Were Cabbages sneaks up on you, man. We're everywhere.
I keep bumping into you people, and you're just all over, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah. They're a great group, and they put together fantastic projects, and it's also a great community. You know, I can go there and I can post up some things I'm working on and people can look at them and give me feedback, and everyone's very trustworthy and everyone's very talented. So you get great feedback and you know, your stuff's not going to go wandering, and you know, Work Cabbages are they're pretty awesome people. Yeah. You know,
that's cool. Definitely. Well, I'll have to make it a point to talk to some more of them as we go along.
Oh yeah. Look them up. They're awesome. Yeah. They're great. So they're fun people. Yeah, I don't know anything else about me. I don't know. I think you've exhausted my level of interesting. I mean, I don't know what else I have to bring to the table here. I gotta have something.
I'm sure we could poke and prod if we really had to.
That's right. Yeah. Something else would come out, but who knows? I don't do origami.
Well, that's interesting. You know, because
yeah, cause some people do.
Some people do, yeah. And you are not in that category.
Yeah, no, I'm fundamentally opposed to the whole concept of origami. It insults me on several levels. I'm just kidding.
Now that would be interesting.
No, actually, I love origami. I tried to figure it out, and I can't do it. I can't figure it out.
I think I learned the paper crane thing when I was in fourth grade. Never got any further.
Oh, so you got further than me.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely.
Well, awesome. Well,
cool, yeah.
Thanks for coming on the show, and I look forward to seeing how Blood of the Gorgon turns out.
Oh, right on, Jeff. Thanks so much, man. All right, thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, and we'll have to get you back on again here in a little while and see what new stuff comes out of you.
You got it. I'll come back anytime. Thanks for having me, man.
Sounds great.
All right.
Well, that is our very special interview with Nicholas Logue about the new open design project, Blood of the Gorgon. Like in every episode, I want to give you a quick promo for a show that I can recommend straight from my own MP3 player. And here it is.
Hey, what's with all the monkeys at the typewriters?
They're writing stuff for our podcast.
I thought they were supposed to be writing Shakespeare.
Common misconception.
So, what's the podcast called again?
Oh, Gamer's Haven.
Thousand Monkey Productions presents Gamer's Haven.
Whatever.
So, why don't we tell these people what it's about?
People. I only see monkeys. Ow.
No, he's talking about the people out there.
Oh. Still don't see any people.
They're the listeners.
Is that anything like the Watchers?
No. Just tell them what the podcast is about.
Oh, we have a podcast?
Oh, brother.
What?
The podcast the monkeys are working on.
I thought they were writing Shakespeare.
Just tell the listeners that the podcast... It's Gamer's Haven, a podcast about games and advice on how to run them.
If they were listening, I wouldn't have to repeat myself.
Well, that made no sense.
Huh? I wasn't listening.
Ow. We do topical shows to help game masters out there.
Is that like a topical cream? Oh, I've got this horrible rash.
Just run the stock clip.
Visit us on the web at CanadianCrusaders.FistfulOfComics.com.
Again, this is a show that I can personally recommend as one that I find to be of good quality. So, if you're looking for some gaming chatter from the perspective of the GM, check out Gamer's Haven. That's episode 42. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. Participate by sending in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com, or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also dig the show at dig.com, vote for us at Podcast Alley, or leave an iTunes review. All these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a percentage of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air and improving. All this information, the forum, and more can be found on the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at www.fistfulofcomics.com. For all sorts of geeky goodness, and Gamer's Haven at www.canadiancrusaders for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 42, Nicholas Logue and Blood of the Gorgon of
The Tome.